would a Shakespeare play by an author of another name still be so good? Most academic scholars today generally agree that the William Shakespeare, born in Stratford-upon-Avon in 1564, is the same guy who wrote your Romeo and Juliet's, Hamlet's, Macbeth's, and countless other works that continue to shape English literature to this day. But there have been alternative theories for decades, even centuries, arguing that somebody else wrote some or all of Shakespeare's work. In a new book, our next guest surveys the world of anti-Stratfordians, the people who argue for different authors of Shakespeare plays and poetry, and makes the case that the world of Shakespeare scholarship should be more open to the question of possible alternative authors of the works attributed to Shakespeare. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a Shakespeare a fan yourself? Do you go see plays here in Wisconsin? Have you joined the debate, the arguments over whether Shakespeare was the author or somebody else? Are you on one of the teams that's gotten into this argument? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Elizabeth Winkler is a journalist and book critic. She's the author of the new book, Shakespeare Was a Woman and Other Heresies, How Doubting the Bard Became the Biggest Taboo in Literature. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Now, you've written about this some in the past. What first led you into the question of did he or didn't he write these books or plays?
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating mystery, and it's something that writers and thinkers have debated for a long time. It tends to provoke highly emotional, sometimes furious responses when people question Shakespeare. And so as a journalist, I just find that so fascinating. You know, why does a question about the authorship of 400-year-old plays get people so riled up? And how is it possible that Henry James, Mark Twain, Vladimir Nabokov, Supreme Court justices, you know, professors of philosophy, history, theater, psychology have all doubted the authorship, but within English departments, the question is effectively forbidden.
That's a big point of your book. You make the case that official academic scholarship should be more open to alternate ideas. What is some of the response you've gotten, both to your past article, to your book, from, I guess, official Shakespeare study?
Well, it's interesting. Quietly, some professors will admit that they have doubts about the authorship. After I published an Atlantic article 4 years ago, Was Shakespeare a Woman? Very controversial. And then someone, a professor at a very prestigious university, reached out to me saying, yes, look, of course, Shakespeare could have been a pseudonym or a scam or a committee of various other people. But he sort of wasn't too, he didn't want to be public about it. You know, you get sort of ridiculed if you say that. And it's a little bit, it's awkward. No one wants to be called a conspiracy theorist or, you know, neurotic fantasist. And these are some of the terms of sort of abuse that get thrown out if you question the god of English literature. But as soon as you go outside of English departments, there's a huge amount of interest in the topic. And I encountered sociologists, historians, Shakespeare actors, you know, who all have questions about who the author really was, and often their own theories about it.
And then
one of my favorite quotes is from an anthropologist, a professor at Rutgers University, who said to ask Shakespeare scholars to look into the authorship is like asking the College of Cardinals to honestly research the resurrection.
You also survey the world of people who support one candidate or another as the alternate authors of Shakespeare's works. Can you give us a quick survey of who is in the field for people who make these arguments?
Sure. In the 19th century, Francis Bacon, the Elizabethan philosopher and statesman, was the first sort of popular candidate. And that's because Bacon was a lawyer. And in the 19th century, people started realizing just what a deep knowledge of the law is in the plays. When Shakespeare's reaching for metaphors, he often uses legal language. One judge wrote that he seems to almost have thought in legal phrases and expressions, but the documented life of William Shakespeare of Stratford-upon-Avon shows no legal training, no legal knowledge, you know, whatsoever. So it's this great kind of discrepancy between what we see in the plays, the knowledge in the plays, and what we actually know of the man's documented life. And then after, you know, Bacon was popular for a while, then it became Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, who traveled through the parts of Italy with which the plays seem most familiar, you know, parts of Venice and Florence, and there's deep sort of geographical knowledge of cities and Italian customs and the Italian language and also parallels some people have pointed to between Oxford's life and the plays that seem to reflect his experiences or his relationships. Then there have been various women who have been put forward. Mary Sidney, the Countess of Pembroke, was first suggested in 1931 as a collaborator in a group of writers. Someone thought that the plays had a kind of feminine intuition. Actually, a lot of people have suspected there was something oddly female about Shakespeare. Orson Welles said Shakespeare was clearly tremendously feminine. So there's this question of, was there a woman somewhere involved in the writing of the plays in the group who simply didn't receive attribution at the time? And she had a sort of salon at her literary estate, which was a sort of school for writers. And the First Folio, the collection of Shakespeare's plays published in 1623, was dedicated to her sons. I can go on about some of the other candidates, but those have been a few of them.
Yeah, a common argument is that, okay, the stuff that comes out of Shakespeare's plays doesn't match up with what we know about his life experience. But, you know, as an author, a creative type, he could have talked to lawyers at the local tavern. He could have talked to sailors about their trips to Italy. Like, he could have done author stuff and discovered all of this. Does this really, his life experience really disqualify him?
Well, I've heard those arguments, of course, that's what scholars say, but I just think they're a bit of a stretch, you know, because when writers go to reach for figurative language, for metaphors, you don't go read up a book on the law just so you can write legal metaphors. When you reach for figurative language, you're drawing from what's sort of in your subconscious, what the images that are with you and that come to you naturally. And there's such specific language about certain places and, you know, experiences that it's hard to see how he would have acquired that without firsthand experience. But yeah, this is why it's a tricky question, because of course writers imagine and make up, and that's, you know, that's part of the work of, you know, of creative production. And that's why it's such a tricky thing to pin down. But well, I think there is pretty substantial reason, at least for doubt, you know, there are reasons to ask the question.
But if it was Francis Bacon, how did he know all the woman stuff? If it was Mary Sidney, why was she reaching out for all these legal metaphors? Don't some of the same arguments targeting Shakespeare target the others?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, it becomes very hard to pin it just on one person. And there's an increasing move to seeing the plays actually as collaborative works. Right. Even Shakespeare scholars now are acknowledging that the plays were probably co-authored, that he didn't write them alone. And I think the reason why it's been so hard to pin down an answer to this question over the years is that it's not a simple answer. You know, it probably wasn't just one person. There are probably a number of hands involved in these plays over the years, because Elizabethan writers did work collaboratively, a bit like Hollywood screenwriters write collaboratively today.
We're talking to Elizabeth Winkler about her new book. It's called Shakespeare Was a Woman and Other Heresies: How Doubting the Bard Became the Biggest Taboo in Literature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a Shakespeare fan, if you've participated in the debates over who Shakespeare was, who wrote the works attributed to Shakespeare, love to hear from you with your thoughts or questions for our guest. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Coming up, a look at what we do and don't know about Shakespeare's life. That's coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Elizabeth Winkler. Her new book is Shakespeare Was a Woman and Other Heresies: How Doubting the Bard Became the Biggest Taboo in Literature. You can join in with your thoughts and questions on the topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, before we go to our callers, one of the difficulties here is we don't necessarily know as much as we'd like about the life of the actual Shakespeare, whether or not he was the author. Could you talk about the limits of our knowledge about the historical figure?
Sure. Well, scholars have turned up a mass of personal records from his lifetime, actually more, it is often said, than we have for other writers of the period. So the records we have show his theatrical activities, his financial and property transactions, his lawsuits. They show that he was a businessman, an actor, a shareholder in an acting company, and a property investor. But what's missing is evidence that he wrote. And as the Oxford historian Blair Warden laments, the extent and loudness of the documentary silence are startling. So for scholars, the silence is quite aggravating. Stanley Wells, one of Britain's leading Shakespeareans, said, "I would love to find a contemporary document that said William Shakespeare was the dramatist of Stratford-upon-Avon written during his lifetime. That would shut the buggers up." So it's very aggravating that there's not the kind of evidence of a literary life that scholars want to be able to point to.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Wausau. Jim, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Jim?
Well, I'm calling about a humor writer named Will Cuppy, C-U-P-P-Y, who left a posthumous book called How to Get from January to December. And his essay for April 9th concerns the topic for you and your guest. It's very brief. It reads this. Dear sir, to settle a bet, please tell me whether Sir Francis Bacon wrote Shakespeare's plays. Answer yes or no. Signed, bewildered. And this is the response. About all I care to say at present is that Francis Bacon, Baron Verulam, and Viscount St. Albans wrote some fine essays, became Lord Chancellor of England, was convicted of bribery and corruption, and died on April 9th, 1626, of bronchitis contracted while stuffing a fowl with snow. Some very charming and lovable people believe that he wrote Shakespeare's plays. You can't spot these people at sight. Only an expert can tell that there is anything unusual about them, that is, in their lucid intervals. This department does not answer bets, but maybe you can read between the lines.
Jim, thanks for the call. Kind of a playful critique, Elizabeth, of anti-Stratfordians there. I don't know, is there a more pleasant and less vitriolic way to have these debates than some of what you've encountered?
I think there should be. You know, academic inquiry should all be about discussion and debate, right? It's very odd that this taboo persists in the modern university system. It's almost treated as heresy, really. It's kind of religious in nature. I think to understand that, to understand it, you have to go back to the origin of English departments. And they were founded in the 19th century during a period of tremendous sort of deification of Shakespeare, when he was held up as a national icon, even a kind of god. And ideas about Shakespeare were enshrined in English departments during this period of extreme veneration. He's really, you know, Britain's Christ figure in a way. And they've been passed down from one generation of scholars to the next. So it becomes very hard to talk about the subject without provoking really emotional responses.
Thanks for that call. Jack joins us now in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, good afternoon.
What did you want to ask about, Jack?
Yeah, so one of the comments I heard your guest make as you were starting out the program was kind of the parallels between as anti-Stratfordians and people like conspiracy theorists, especially those vis-a-vis the Kennedy assassination, the moon landings, or other historical events. And so my first question was, what parallels are there between like general conspiracy theorists and the anti-Stratfordian movement or school of thought? And then also, why is it considered taboo for English teachers and kind of insiders to kind of question Shakespeare's work here, but then not those on the outside?
Jack, thanks for the call. First of all, Elizabeth, I assume you'd like to compare and contrast, or you'd like to contrast yourself with conspiracy theories like the ones that Jack just listed.
Well, I think it's a false equivalence to make. You know, the accusation of conspiracy theory is it's sort of thrown out to make anyone who questions Shakespeare seem like a crank. You know, it's a way of sidestepping questions about the authorship and making people sort of afraid to challenge the dogma, because who wants to be called a conspiracy theorist, right? But in fact, literary history is full of writers who concealed their authorship. And the Renaissance was actually a great age of assumed names. There were a lot of writers who either made up fake names or took on other people's names. That's an important thing to understand. I think it was a practice that you would write under someone else's name if you, for some reason, didn't want to put out work under your own. So calling it a conspiracy theory is just sort of silly, I think. This is a literary practice. Concealed authorship is a well-known literary practice. So what was the second question about?
Why on the insiders in effect reject this, viewed as you say, a heresy, but it seems to be popular for people outside of the official academic profession.
Yeah, it's because Shakespeare is the god of English literature, you know, and Shakespeare is the god of really sort of a national icon in Britain. And so there's a painting in the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. of Shakespeare in a nativity scene as a kind of Christ figure that was done in the 18th century. If you go to Stratford-upon-Avon in England, there's it's set up as a kind of Bethlehem where you can worship at the site of Shakespeare's birth, even though they have no idea if he was really born there. So there's all this sort of religious iconography and religious thinking that accrues around Shakespeare. And the idea that I've often heard is that, you know, the appropriate response to the mystery, the beautiful mystery of how he created these works, is simply veneration of his genius rather than questioning. And it's so funny to me that, you know, they don't want you to question, just venerate the genius. But it's very religious, ultimately.
Thanks for that call, Jack. In our last less than a minute, Elizabeth, where do you stand now? Who done it? Who do you think is the author or authors?
You know, I decided I wasn't going to argue for any candidate in this book. I've written about the theories, and I sort of let the reader wander through this fascinating, strange world and make up their own mind about the authorship. The book it's a work of journalism. It's a work of literary history. I interview a lot of scholars and a lot of skeptics in it. And I wanted to sort of paint the whole strange world of the authorship question and let readers figure it out for themselves.
Elizabeth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Elizabeth Winkler, journalist and book critic. She talked to us about her new book, and I think I can vouch for her. She wrote this one, Shakespeare Was a Woman and Other Heresies, How Doubting the Bard Became the Biggest Taboo in Literature. Rising temperatures across the country could drive more people to the Great Lakes region. No one knows exactly what climate change will mean for Wisconsin's population. But as Danielle Kading reports, the changing climate is already playing a role in some people's decision to relocate.
Right now, there's no room for anything.
Colleen Rooney and her husband, Jim, are still unpacking. They moved to their new lakeside home in Vilas County last month. When they arrived, tall snowbanks blocked their view of the water.
I actually had to hire someone to come take a skid loader and get the snow away from the garage so we can unload the truck.
The Rooneys lived in Las Vegas for 20 years. Rarely did they deal with snow, but they did face intense heat.
You just didn't go anywhere when it was 115 degrees outside. You know, just to walk from your car to a grocery store across that blacktop was brutal.
While it wasn't the sole factor, the couple says extreme heat played a role in their decision to move to Wisconsin. Now some people are asking whether climate change could end up bringing more people to the state. A new group has formed to examine climate migration. Anna Haynes is a professor at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point who's heading a committee to explore the issue.
We kept hearing about people are moving because of climate, sea level rise, big hurricanes, wildfires. So should Wisconsin be worried about this?
Haynes says they'll examine the positive and disruptive effects of climate migration and share any practices that can help communities. Climate migration experts like Jesse Keenan say people may seek out the Great Lakes region for its abundant access to fresh water. He's a professor of sustainable real estate at Tulane University in New Orleans.
The Great Lakes are where you begin in many ways, in the upper Midwest in particular. It's just much more mediating changing climate.
Even so, Keenan says no place is immune to climate change. Temperatures in Wisconsin could rise between 2 and 8 degrees by mid-century. Steve Vavaris is director of the State Climatology Office and a climate scientist at UW-Madison.
We talk about Wisconsin maybe relatively better than other parts of the country, but relatively is the key term because we have our own challenges.
As the Southwest struggles with access to water, Wisconsin has seen too much. The last decade was the state's wettest on record since the 1890s, and the state saw flooding and major storms. But because Wisconsin hasn't typically seen intense heat, some people argue that global warming will benefit Wisconsin. In a recent Senate Budget Committee hearing, Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson had this to say about a recent study of the projected effects of rising temperatures.
In my own state, your study shows that we'd have a reduction in mortality of somewhere between 54 and 56 people per, I guess it's 100,000. Why wouldn't we take comfort in that?
The study's authors say the effects of climate change will be very unequal. While Wisconsin may see fewer deaths due to cold, damages will be much worse across large sections of the country. Wisconsin saw a net gain of roughly 16,000 residents in the last year, and about half of them came from other states. But determining who may be a climate migrant is complex. That's according to Catherine Curtis, an environmental sociology professor at UW-Madison.
People tend to move for many reasons and sometimes intersecting reasons. And the climate or environmental conditions are certainly reasons for some people, but possibly only indirectly.
Colleen Rooney's family used to vacation and live in northern Wisconsin. Her emotional ties to the area played a role in the couple's decision to move. Curtis says federal census data shows most people moving to Vilas County come from nearby states, but they're also seeing residents relocate from states like California and Florida. She says that suggests climate migration could be happening, but stronger evidence is needed. While the Rooneys sought to beat the heat, they also had reservations about the cold. Jim says he initially moved away to escape long winters.
It seemed like things were mellowing out, but then we get up here and we got, you know, how many feet of snow and cold.
Even so, Colleen says there's not a snowball's chance they would ever move back out west. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a therapist who's also a professional baker about finding the mental health benefits in making cakes, cookies, and pies in the kitchen. That's our Food Friday conversation, and we want to hear from you. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you bake as a method of self-care? Do you find stress relief when you're baking stuff, sweet or savory? Email ideas@WPR.org or post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page and then stick around until after the news for that conversation. Remember, you can listen all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org to the Ideas Network or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app for live streaming and our extensive archives, plus a lot of recipes. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.